so here we go. Debriefs work is, you know, a combination of exploratory work just to describe what's out there, because these are areas that have been hard to study in the past and haven't received as much work as the shallow areas. But we're trying to move that on to an understanding of the processes that happen in these deep reefs to maintain the reefs and how they might compare with reefs in shallow water. So this is an overview of the work, and if you've been to any of the previous symposia for the Ningaloo Outlook program, you'll know that we've done a fair bit of work to map substrata using multi-beam sonar, towed video, the Starbug AUV, and so on, and to classify the communities in those habitats. So I'll talk a bit about some of those things and some of the novel things that we've found out there. But a lot of today's talk is going to focus on the work that we're starting to do to understand the processes that maintain those deep water reefs and how they compare with those in shallow water. So principally recruitment processes, and also a bit about the variability in coral cover as a reflection of the dynamics and the sort of frequency of impacts, ability to recover, and so on. It's early days there, but we're in a position now where we can start to make some progress. So, novel assemblages. And so what I've got here is a bed of these little Cycloceras corals, Cycloceras distorta. So we first noticed these back in the first cruises that we did out to Ningaloo as little brown blobs on the bottom. And they seem to occur in certain places and not others. So we focused in on those in particular last year to try and map out exactly where these things were occurring and how many of them there were. And there are a lot. In fact, the density here is probably around 100 per square meter. The average density in this bed is about 51 per square meters. It's almost 3 kilometers long, but only 90 meters wide on average. So it's a pretty thin strip that these corals just seem to love. And it's very dense. It's like the equivalent of putting half Australia's population into Bondi Beach. It's kind of, if you scale it up to human terms. So it's quite dense, and the question is, well, why are there so many of them in this very small area? One explanation could be that it's got just the right combination of physical factors for the growth and survival of these things. So you can see they're brown, so they do have zooxanthellae. They need light, and there's some algae out there, so that's consistent. But they don't extend any deeper than that. They might run out of light, and maybe closer to this reef here, which is what's indicated by that black sort of substratum. There could be too much wave resuspension or something like that. So it's just right here for them. And another reason why they might be so dense has to do with their mode of reproduction. So Cycloceras distorta, because it's kind of, it's not really a very nicely shaped mushroom coral. It's kind of lumpy looking. And that's because it's got these little fracture lines. So these things can grow and reproduce asexually. They break into pieces. Those pieces can continue to grow, form a new coral. And voila, you end up with a dense bed of coral. So, you know, it's just kind of a really interesting natural history story, and I really think we need to have these kinds of positive tales to tell. So last year I gave a talk about the bad things that are happening on coral reefs, like coral bleaching in the Pilbara, crown of thorns waves. When I finished that talk, I could hear people saying, oh God, that's depressing. But that was a talk at Chevron. This is a talk for BHP. So, and this really got out into the media and got noticed quite a bit. So it's really great to see that people know there's something out there that's worth saving on coral reefs, and all hope is not lost. But what about the ecological processes? These are the sort of things that we need to know to hope to try and manage these resources in the longer term. And the first thing I'm going to talk about is recruitment. So there's been a lot of thinking about deep reefs or mesophotic reefs in the context of the myriad of disturbances that are experienced on shallow reefs. Everyone knows about those, and the hope was that these deep reefs are protected from those disturbances. They might be a way for larvae to come up from deep water and recruit into those shallow places, restoring the corals and keeping reefs safe, even though there's cyclones and bleaching and all sorts of things like that. So that's got a lot of implications for climate change and reef resilience. And also, how do recruitment rates vary in general in relation to shallow water? And that can affect how rapidly deep reefs might recover from disturbances relative to those in shallow water. So, you know, that's another important thing to know. The thing is that it's not easy to study coral recruitment in deep water. It's deep, and we're not allowed to dive there anymore. So we have to have different ways to understand recruitment and to measure it. So Damien is able to dive down, attach these little recruitment tiles onto the reef, go back down and pick them up. But you know, we're not going to be able to dive down to 40 meters, look around for these things, finally find them, go back up to the surface and do that at multiple sites. You know, it's just too dangerous. It's not practical. We probably just wouldn't find them anyway. So, you know, we had to develop a new method to do that. And using that method, we're trying to test this hypothesis that would help us understand whether these deep reefs are really a refugia for shallow water corals. So I'm just going to go through the kind of hypothesis that we thought would help us understand this role and whether it was actually possible. So it's kind of difficult to work out where a larva came from. You can't track it, it doesn't have a label on it. So when it settles, you're not sure whether it came from nearby or deeper down or down the reef, down the road. But the thinking goes like this. If deep reefs really act as refugia, the larvae that are released from these corals would have to be well mixed throughout the water column. So there'd be an even spread of settling corals in shallow and deep water. And the corals settling on those reefs would have a fairly similar composition, if not also a similar relative abundance. And then any differences between shallow and deep water assemblages of corals would arise due to settlement or post-settlement mortality. Okay, so all of those larvae, only the ones that are suited to that habitat survive. So if we looked at recruitment, we'd see even recruitment or settlement assemblages in deep and shallow water. On the other hand, if that hypothesis of deep water refugia is not true, we should see differences in the recruitment and settlement of corals in deep and shallow water that reflects that the larvae from the shallow water corals are staying in the shallow water and the deep water ones in the deep water, and they're not really mixing, so they don't really act as refugia. There's not a lot of movement from one to the other. So we can test that by looking at the assemblages on those settlement tiles, the same ones that Damien used. And this is how we did it. So instead of attaching the tiles onto the reef or diving down, we attached them onto these concrete paving blocks. These are the same tiles and attached by the same means. They're identical in every way except they're just attached to the concrete blocks, which are then dropped down to the bottom exactly at the same time as the ones that were attached to the reef by Damien, and also right next to them in the shallow and the slope site, so we could compare the effectiveness of the two methods. But also we put them at 24 meters and at 40 meters, much deeper. And this is what some of those looked like at the end of the study. Then we just have to retrieve them, pull them back up into the boat, and then count them in the same way as usual. And we found out there's no difference in the number of recruits or in the composition of the recruits on those tiles relative to the standard deployment that was done with tiles right onto the reef at the same depth stratum. So, right, we've got a comparable method that we can use to study recruitment right throughout the depth range. And here are some of the results. So this is what coral recruits look like. They start to lay down a skeleton within hours or days of settlement. So you can see the traces of these things from virtually as soon as they settle. These ones are a couple of months old. So this is what they'd look like by the time we pulled them up out of the water. And so this is it, Acropora, Bosylopora, Parotids, and others. You can't easily differentiate recruits of the other families reliably, okay? But you can separate out Acropora and Montipora by the size of this primary calyx, and also the Bosyloporids. You can separate out into Bosylopora and Stylophora. And you see that there's another Goldilocks zone here where most of the recruitment is happening at about 25 meters, much higher than at the other depths. So why this is exactly, we don't know, but there do definitely seem to be some patterns in that recruitment rate that probably have some consequences for the overall coral cover, as we'll look at a little bit later. And also, importantly, in relation to that overall hypothesis, is the assemblage of recruits the same in shallow water and deep water? Well, these are the data. I should have put a better label on this, but these are the recruits, and this is the percent coral cover. And if you just look at the overall trend here for the different taxa, Acropora, Parotids, Bosyloporids, and others, you can see, mostly Acropods, Parotids, Bosyloporids is probably the lowest recruitment, and then others. And patterns at different depths with 40 meters, 25, 8 meters, and 3 meters, it's different for each taxa. So for the Acropods, mostly at 25 meters. For the Parotids, it's mostly at 8 meters. Same for Bosylopora, that's where the peak recruitment occurs. And that overall trend is kind of similar for the adult coral cover, which peaks at around 20 meters or so. So when you actually do some multivariate statistics of these to see how the recruit assemblage varies as a function of what the adult coral assemblage is, find that there is a significant relationship between the recruits that are settling and the adult assemblage. So it's not random. In fact, the recruit assemblage is related to the adult assemblage. So it looks like the larvae are settling in a similar way to the adult assemblage, and the adult assemblage structure is determined by that pattern in settlement. So either where the larvae are swimming in the water column or how they're making their settlement choices. So probably the potential for deep waters corals to act as refugia for shallow waters is somewhat limited. Just going on to coral variability, I guess it's been pretty much assumed that deep water corals will be less variable than shallow water corals because of various factors like less exposure to wave energy, lower temperatures, less effect of stratification and heating in the shallow water, and so on. But again, difficult to test because we haven't had ways to get down there and study these deep water coral assemblages on a regular basis. And again, we've got some new ways of doing that at Ningaloo, particularly using this AUV, the Starbug, which allows us to get down and survey large areas of reef below 20 meters and up to 100 meters, in fact. So we've done now 2 years of surveys at Ningaloo, so we can look at how coral cover has varied over that short period, admittedly, but at least it'll start to give us an idea of how coral cover varies from 1 year to the next for the first time at Ningaloo. So we targeted coral cover at this 20 to 26 meter stratum, which is roughly around where the peak of coral cover is. So it should make the task of comparing coral cover easier. And we've got 7 transects that we used at Helby Banks, Mangrove, and Tantabiti using the Starbug X. So the Starbug will dive down on a pre-programmed route, collecting images and also environmental data, come back up to the surface where you can download the data. And it'll have a USBL beacon strapped onto it so we know exactly where it's gone and whether it's followed its charted course. And just some really simple results from that show that the overall coral cover is very similar from one year to the next. So it's varying by less than 1%. And if you look at it by depth, it's very similar from one year to the next across those substrata within that 20 to 26 meter range. So it seems fairly constant, consistent with our hypothesis about the relative stability of deeper coral reefs. However, coral cover still is pretty variable down there, as you can see by those error bars. So there's aspects of the sampling that are probably driving variability at small scales, and you know that's going to impair our ability to detect real changes. So one of the challenges for us going ahead is to start planning our missions in such a way that we can reduce that variability in the repeat transects and increase our power to detect smaller changes in the assemblages and the amount of information that we can get out of these surveys. So just to conclude on these, the patterns of recruitment suggest that deep water reefs are not really major refugia for shallow water reefs, and that's consistent with some genetic studies that have been done. Also, that coral cover on deep reefs may indeed be more stable than in shallow waters, but it's early days, it's only 1 year, and we've got to look at longer time series. So we'll be delving into some of the IMOS, the Integrated Marine Observing Systems AUV data that goes back to 2007. And that'll allow us to look at decadal change on some of these deeper reefs and also on some of the shallow ones that are nearby to where we collected the data I've just shown you. So in future, we'll start to get rapidly get more insights into that. And there's probably plenty left to discover out there. So we're really looking forward to the next couple of years of our work at Ningaloo. I'd like to thank a lot of people who've helped make this work possible. First of all, our partnership with BHP is just hugely important, but also, I've got the name wrong, I know it's changed now, but I'm a creature of habit, used to be DPOL. The crew of the Linnaeus, of course, the multi-beam team that's helped us out up there, the engineering and electronic workshop that keeps the Starbug functioning, Mark Wilson down here for making everything happen, and also the comms people, Joe and Asia, who've helped get the word out for this work. Thanks very much.